Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel, a very fine journalist who publishes a small semi-weekly newspaper up in Napa, California, has been covering the Casalero case for quite some time. At this point, Harry Martin, I think it could be said, holds the journalistic high ground vis-a-vis the Inslaw case, one of the legs of the octopus that Joseph Daniel Casalero was following. By the way, before I get into this next Harry Martin article concerning the death of Joseph Daniel Casalero, I would like to remind listeners that Harry Martin is doing a number of investigative series on the U.S. National Security Establishment. Many of those series are available from the Napa Sentinel in terms of press packets. You can obtain those by contacting the Napa Sentinel at 925 Lincoln Avenue, 925 Lincoln Avenue, as in Honest Abe. That's in Napa, California, zip code 94558. The phone number up there is area code 707-257-6272, 707-257-NAPA. By the way, Harry also is working on a very important series right now with David Call, last name C-A-U-L. Dave Call is our Napa Sentinel with a small s, the listener up there who has served as a liaison between myself and Harry Martin over the years. And once again, David Call is doing a series with Harry Martin on mind control in the Napa Sentinel. It is a very, very fine series. I don't know how much of it I'll be accessing on the air or whether I will be accessing any of it on the air, because most of the information is information that are in the Radio Free America shows about mind control. That's Radio Free America programs 5, 6, and 7. In fact, some of the information from the Radio Free America shows has found its way into the Napa Sentinel series, but it is a very, very fine series about mind control, a subject that most people simply will not touch, and it's very refreshing to see a journalistic medium approaching what is frankly an untouchable subject for most. It also does expand beyond some of the material in the archive shows that I did on mind control, and it links some of the people that we're seeing on the stage today, such as Dr. Earl Bryan, with aspects of mind control. It's an excellent series, and I strongly encourage listeners to this program to get a hold of it and to access it to people that are not familiar with the unfortunate story of mind control. As I mentioned, Harry Martin has been holding the journalistic high ground on the Inslaw case for quite some time, and beyond that, he also has been doing some excellent work about the death of Joseph Daniel Casalero, an investigative reporter who was almost certainly murdered for getting too close to the truth concerning a number of intersecting investigations. Some of the tentacles of what he referred to as the octopus involve the Iran-Contra scandal. That would certainly include Noriega's situation. Much of Noriega's drug trafficking appears to have been undertaken on behalf of the Contra support effort. Also the Iran-Contra scandal proper, the related October surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages taken from the U.S. embassy there in November of 79 until Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. Also the BCCI scandal, the scandal surrounding the Bank of Credit and Commerce International that we will be talking about later, as well as the Inslaw case. There are considerable degrees of intersection between these various scandals, although obviously they are not coterminous. In the Napa Sentinel of Friday, September 27th of 1991, Harry Martin had yet another article about the Joseph Daniel Casalero case. This will go into the archives as a supplement to the archive show that we've already done, featuring to a considerable extent Virginia McCullough's information. The name of that archive show, by the way, is called For Whom the Bell Tolls, The Death of Joseph Daniel Casalero. Once again, reading from the Napa Sentinel of Friday, September 27th of 1991, this is a story by Harry Martin, copyright Napa Sentinel, about Joseph Daniel Casalero. It's headlined, Death of a Journalist, what the investigative writer was doing before he died, who he was eyeing. I'm going to read the entire article into the record. Journalist Danny Casalero had a tenacious, bulldog approach to his investigative journalism. He would research his subject and then have a face-to-face confrontation with that subject. There were no holds barred. That style of journalism may have cost him his life. Casalero is one of many journalists, attorneys, and investigators who have perished in their search for the truth about this nation, about clandestine government operations, private arms, drug dealers, and the CIA. Casalero was found dead in a West Virginia hotel room. His wrists had been slashed 10 times. He was not only ruled a suicide, but his body was embalmed and buried before his family was even notified. But was it suicide? Too many deaths, too many suspicious circumstances lay challenge to that pronunciation. But this article is not about Danny's death. It is about his life. The Sentinel has received exclusive inside information on what Danny was doing before he died, who and what he was investigating, and where he was receiving his information from. Danny was writing a book that would blow the socks off Washington. It began to connect the Bank of Credit and Commerce International scandal with Inslaw, the Iran-Contra deals, Israeli-U.S. secret arrangements, misuse of Indian tribes, drug trafficking, and murder, all into one neat and sordid package. Before his death, he thought he had cracked all the necessary mysteries to link what he called the octopus of the American government. Danny at one time worked with Jack Anderson, a nationally acclaimed Washington columnist. One of his key contacts was Alan D. Standorf, S-T-A-N-D-O-R-F. According to Danny, Standorf was a key supplier of documents that exposed the giant government scandal in banking, intelligence, and underworld ties. Standorf was working in a very sensitive and secret communication center for the U.S. government. He could listen in or intercept message traffic from the intelligence community. Standorf supplied volumes of secret documents to Danny. High-speed Xerox commercial duplicating and collating machinery was set up in the Hilton Hotel in room 900 to provide Danny copies of all documents and allow Standorf time to place the documents back in their original files. But then Danny lost his source. Standorf was found dead at Washington, D.C.'s National Airport. He died of a blow to the head. His body was found on the back floor of his car under a pile of luggage and personal items. Danny also had contact with Dennis Eisman and Michael Riconosciuto. Eisman, who was to represent Riconosciuto in a criminal trial, was in contact with Danny on a frequent basis. Riconosciuto is a key witness in the Inslaw case and on the October surprise investigation, as well as Iran-Contra. Riconosciuto apparently was the key electronics man for the U.S. intelligence community. He was arrested 7 days after providing Congress with testimony in the Inslaw case. Eisman is now dead with a single bullet wound to the chest. They say it was suicide as well. Eisman was to have picked up critical information at a parking lot the day he was shot. That information was destined for Danny and Riconosciuto, but it never came to be. Danny called the Inslaw case the frosting on the cake of his investigation. He claimed to know all the Washington players in the octopus from the White House, from the White House and Justice Department right down to the intelligence community and mob ties. He was investigating the following individuals and companies at the time of his death. And here's a list of, once again, individuals and companies and institutions. Many of them are familiar to me. Many of them have appeared in past articles, but many of them are new, and some of them, frankly, I don't know anything about. So I will read them, and hopefully this will serve as a vehicle for interested journalists and researchers to pursue some of these connections. The list here, once again from the Napa Sentinel of Friday, September 27th of 1991, Dominic and Bob Bolsano, B-O-L-S-A-N-O. Never heard of either of them. Gemini Industries, I haven't heard of them. The Papago Indian Tribe, the Menominee Indian Tribe, the Cabazon Indian Tribe, the Primerit Bank of Nevada, BCCI, and 300 other financial institutions. We will see interesting links later on in the broadcast between the BCCI and other financial institutions. Dr. Earl Bryan, Peter Vedeniex, Community Banking of Southern California, Home Savings of Seattle, Theodore Strand, Robert Booth Nichols, Department of Commerce EDA Funds, the Wackenhut Corporation, former B of A Director Bill Jensen, along with loan sharks, mafia and mob ties, and links between the deaths of Indians and journalist Don Bowles, who was killed in a car explosion in Arizona many years ago. Danny was also examining the gold platinum smuggling that came from Southeast Asia through Mexico and then through the Papago Indian Reservation in New Mexico. He fingered a corridor between Mexico and New Mexico, which was allowed to be opened and which the Drug Enforcement Agency refused to patrol. He was also looking at gold shipments from the Republic of South Vietnam. According to an inside informant, Danny was threatened by a man who controls the Indian tribes. Quote, "Now that you know this stuff, you will have to die," unquote, Danny reported was the threat. He was also concerned with the IBM Tel Aviv connection, which could link the use of Inslaw's Promise software to Israeli intelligence. Danny was in contact with Bill Hamilton of Inslaw and was scheduled to meet with Vedeniex and Bryan about the time he died. He had 6 file folders with him at all times. Just before his alleged meeting, he brought the folders home. In a search of his house, no documents were reported found. Those documents were seldom left behind by Danny. Danny had conversations with Michael Allen May, a former Nixon campaign financial aide, who was alleged to have wired $40 million to the Iranians in October of 1980 as a down payment on the hostage deal. May died in San Francisco 4 days after the Napa Sentinel reported his connections to the October surprise. At first, officials said he died of a heart attack, but the autopsy report was changed to reflect that May had polypharmaceuticals in his system. There was an omitted word. One more time. At first, officials said he died of a heart attack, but the autopsy report was changed to reflect that May had polypharmaceuticals in his system. Danny was also working with Anson Ng of the Financial Times of London. Both were zeroing in on the Cabazon Indians' Inslaw-Iran-Contra links. Ng was found dead in Guatemala with a single bullet wound in his chest. Like Iceman and Danny, the verdict was suicide. Peter Zukoski, Z-O-K-O-S-K-Y, had close liaison with Danny. Zukoski had direct dealing with the Cabazon Indians at the time the Inslaw software was being converted for Canadian intelligence, and also knew about the manufacturing of chemical and biological weapons for the Contras through the auspices of the Wackenhut Corporation and the Nichols family. But some of Danny's documents will show such things as a bank in New England which has $400 million in phony bearer bonds used for collateral because the bank's money has been siphoned off. Another will show multi-million dollar loans based on only thousands of dollars of collateral by another bank used to finance drug deals. Danny's octopus was too large, and in the end it ate him up, his records and his life forfeit. There's an awful lot to chew on in this particular article. One of the reasons I read the whole article into the record was so that people could tape this or perhaps get some idea of what is in the article and then get the article itself from the Napa Sentinel. Once again, there is a lot of information in this particular article that reflects information or recalls information from earlier programs, either from some of Harry's articles about the Casolaro and or Inslaw cases, or information presented to us by Virginia McCullough. And once again, we will be hearing from Virginia McCullough later on in the broadcast this evening. There are a lot of new elements here. There's a list of institutions and individuals that Harry Martin, that Danny Casolaro was investigating. Many of them, we've seen before, and many of them are new. It's also interesting to me that Danny Casolaro had been investigating some connecting links between deaths of Indians and the death of journalist Don Bowles, who was killed in a car bomb explosion in Arizona many years ago. In connection with the Casolaro case, I recommended that a methodology that might be pursued by the American journalistic community would be to ape the consortium of journalists who descended on Arizona after the Don Bowles assassination and basically completed his investigation, exposing massive organized crime links with the mainstream political hierarchy of the state of Arizona, connecting links, for example, with Barry Goldwater, among others. I did not realize that there was a connecting link between some of the deaths that and some of the things that Danny Casolaro was investigating and the death of journalist Don Bowles, but it's an interesting bit of synchronicity under the circumstances. Many of these names are new to me. I've never heard the name Peter Zukoski before. It's also interesting to me that Danny Casolaro was working with Jack Anderson. I noted that Jack Anderson had a column about the Casolaro death and cast aspersions on the official version of suicide. So, for what it's worth, it's not meant in a snide sense, but there is the update from Harry Martin on the Casolaro case. A lot of new information, a lot of information from previous broadcasts, and hopefully other journalists and other researchers will pick up on this. And in the methodology used in the Don Bowles case, they will pursue the investigations of the octopus, because over the long run, I think a lot of us stand to benefit from the investigations. If they're successfully completed, we're all going to lose if they are not. Another very interesting development in the Casolaro case concerns the detention of William Richard Turner. That is one of the investigations, one of the people investigating the octopus with Joseph Daniel Casolaro, one of the people who had been functioning as an informant for Casolaro. Turner has been arrested and charged with bank robbery because supposedly witnesses saw someone looking very much like him running away from a bank robbery. There is a problem. Turner only has one leg, and so if the videotape does not show a one-legged man running away, the authorities have a problem. This is from the Napa Sentinel of October 5th of 1991. That was a Friday. And here's an article by Harry Martin. It's entitled Another Leg into the Inslaw Story, sort of a pun, obviously, given the fact that the one-legged situation of William Turner is one of the pieces of evidence which serves to contradict the official version. This article reads, "The man who was a key source of information for investigative journalist Danny Casolaro has been arrested and critical documents have been seized from his home. William Richard Turner, the last known person to see Casolaro alive, was arrested this week and charged with bank robbery. Turner is a former employee of Hughes Aircraft. He is reported to have met with Casolaro in a Sheraton Hotel parking lot and provided him with papers alleging corruption at a local defense plant and also alleged fraud in the aerospace industry and within the ranks of the Defense Investigative Service, which oversees probes of the defense industry. The meeting took place hours before Casolaro was found dead in his hotel room. His wrists had been slashed 10 times. Turner had been fired from Hughes because of his whistleblowing. Casolaro's body was immediately embalmed and buried before his family was notified of his death. The death was ruled to be a suicide. Casolaro had received numerous threats on his life because of the investigations into Inslaw, the Cabazon Indian Nation, mob CIA connections, and the Bank of Commerce and Credit International. Several other, quote, suicides, unquote, have been reported associated with similar investigative efforts by other journalists and attorneys. Turner was being followed by units of the Frederick County Sheriff's Office for his protection. He was aware of the tale. A sheriff's unit pulled alongside Turner's vehicle in a bank parking lot and informed him that someone had reported he was a suspect in the robbery of the Gore branch of the Dominion Bank that morning. That's G-O-R-E, appropriately enough, as in blood. Continuing with the article, Turner was not immediately arrested. He returned home, and the sheriff informed him that he would need to speak to him on the next day. Turner voluntarily signed a waiver allowing authorities to search his home. The following day, he was arrested, and the FBI searched his home. They seized the copies of 40 to 50 documents which Turner had provided Casolaro. They seized notebooks with names and addresses in it, listing contacts that Casolaro had, phone message tapes, and all the files in his desk. All of Casolaro's documents, both in his hotel room and at his home, have not been found. Law enforcement officials indicate that television cameras in the bank show a person with similar characteristics of Turner. They claim to have a witness who saw Turner running from the bank. Turner has only one leg. So another leg into the Inslaw story, a sarcastic pun, obviously, a note of sarcasm from Harry Martin here. It certainly appears as if the extraordinary irregularities surrounding the investigations into the various aspects of the octopus are continuing apace. It would appear that the cover-up of Joseph Daniel Casolaro's death continues apace. Certainly, it seems extraordinarily unusual for William Turner to be handled in that particular fashion, although perhaps we should view that kind of handling as only too typical of the way the octopus and the various investigations connected to it have been investigated. Certainly, the death of Joseph Daniel Casolaro does not appear to have been properly investigated by the authorities, and it's interesting to see one of his informants now being arrested on what would appear to be a phony bank robbery charge, and to see some of his documents being appropriated. I have not seen, obviously, the videotape from the bank camera, but it would seem to be pretty flimsy evidence to have William Turner running away from the bank when William Turner has only one leg. One of the elements in the first of the Harry Martin articles, the one from September 27th, that is discussed, one of the things that Joseph Daniel Casolaro was looking into, were connections between the BCCI, the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, and 300 other financial institutions. We're going to take a look now at some of the emerging elements in the BCCI story. Once again, for the benefit of people that may have tuned in late, I've had a number of inquiries from listeners about when I'm going to do an archive show into the BCCI. I will be doing that at some point in the not-too-distant future, but I want to give the case a chance to develop a little bit more rather than doing addendum after addendum after addendum after addendum. I have been covering the information for some time, and we'll continue to do it. I will be doing an archive show probably by the end of November at the latest, but in any event, I will be definitely doing that at some point. An interesting piece of information emerged concerning the BCCI case this past week. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, October 2nd of 1991, this is a New York Times story, Dateline Washington, headlined, U.S. Blocks Testimony of Two at BCCI Hearing. It reads, the Justice Department has blocked the testimony of two key witnesses scheduled to appear today at a Senate hearing on the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, causing Senator John Kerry, chairman of the panel, to cancel the hearing. The cancellation is the latest incident in a dispute between Senate investigators and the Justice Department. Some in the Senate believe that the Justice Department has tried to hamper the Senate investigation, and the Justice Department says it fears that congressional inquiry could undermine its own investigation of the bank. Senate investigators say they believe that the Justice Department blocked the witnesses, who were employees of the department, because the agency feared that it would be embarrassed by testimony confirming that department officials were slow in investigating BCCI. That last paragraph again. Senate investigators say they believe that the Justice Department blocked the witnesses, who were employees of the department, because the agency feared that it would be embarrassed by testimony confirming that department officials were slow in investigating BCCI. But the agency contends that Kerry, a Massachusetts Democrat, wants the two witnesses to appear at a public hearing to enhance his personal publicity. Our people have a feeling that Mr. Kerry and his people already have all the information they're going to get, unquote, said Doug Tillett, a Justice Department spokesman. Kerry, asked to respond, said, quote, I'm really surprised that the Justice Department is trying to rekindle a battle here and pick a fight about trying to get to the truth. Again, quoting, maybe Justice has something they don't want made public, the senator said. Again, quoting, they shouldn't worry about a public hearing if they have nothing to conceal, unquote. Any attempts by Kerry to compel the witnesses to testify could be blocked if the administration invoked executive privilege, quote unquote. The two prospective witnesses are Robert Mazur, M-A-Z-U-R, who headed the Customs Service investigation of BCCI in Tampa, Florida, and Mark Jakowski, an assistant U.S. attorney who performed the same role for the Justice Department. Mazur led a lengthy undercover investigation. Mazur led a lengthy undercover operation against BCCI several years ago that resulted in several indictments and convictions for money laundering by BCCI and some of its top employees in the United States. It also led to arrests and successful prosecutions of several drug dealers who were using the bank. Mazur resigned from the Customs Service in April. In his letter of resignation, he reportedly charged that the agency had failed to provide the resources needed for the BCCI investigation. Mazur had pushed for a broader investigation of BCCI in America, including its apparent ties to Clark Clifford, the prominent Washington lawyer, and the bank he headed, the First American Bank of Washington. But his suggestions were never followed. Mazur is now in training as an agent of the Drug Enforcement Administration, a part of the Justice Department. One of the aspects of BCCI that I suspect the authorities do not want coming out concerns the stories have emerged. One of the reasons that I think the Justice Department may be blocking these witnesses is that there is abundant evidence that the investigation into BCCI was deliberately frustrated. We will be going into that when I get into the archive show. It should be noted that charges have been leveled at a number of people who lobbied on behalf of BCCI, notably for our purposes here, a fellow named Robert Keith Gray, a longtime Republican operative, an individual with very strong ties to the intelligence community, also a person whose name has emerged in connection with the October surprise. He was one of the lobbyists charged with obstructing the investigation. It should be noted that the BCCI was utilized by elements of U.S. intelligence for a number of different activities, the CIA, the DIA, people like Oliver North, Adnan Khashoggi, and Arif Durrani, all key players in the Iran-Contra weapons traffic. They used BCCI. Noriega used BCCI, and among the curious aspects of the investigation into Noriega was the documents concerning Noriega's use of BCCI disappeared while they were en route to the United States under the custody of the Drug Enforcement Administration. One of a number of irregularities, including the losing of the Takif tape, the deep-sixing of a key witness in the trial of a Noriega co-defendant. I say deep-sixing, he died in a one-car automobile accident. Perhaps it was an accident, but all too often we see that pattern in connection with national security investigations. And it's worth noting that the Defense Intelligence Agency also used BCCI. There was also the so-called black network at BCCI, used for terrorist support activities, drug running, gun running, and apparently the black network was used by U.S. intelligence for a number of different activities. Once again, these two Justice Department employees have been barred from testifying before Congress. This is unfortunately a pattern that we have been seeing in conjunction with congressional investigations. It should be noted that Jack Brooks, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has expressed frustration at the way the U.S. Justice Department has stonewalled the Inslaw investigation, yet another tentacle of the octopus and something which ultimately connects with elements involved with BCCI. The metaphor that Joseph Daniel Casolaro used, that of the octopus, continues to become more appropriate. There is an article that emerged in yesterday's papers, and now I'm going to read from the Chronicle of Saturday, October 5th of 1991. I also saw a story about this in the L.A. Times. Now, Charles Keating, one of the key figures in the failure of the Lincoln Savings and Loan and the looting of the savings and loans, and a fellow who touches a lot of different bases, his name is now coming up in connection with BCCI. He is linked with one of its directors, and in turn, This particular fellow is also, that is to say, this director that Keating's connected with, a fellow named Alfred Hartmann of Switzerland, is also connected with the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, a bank that I will talk more about in just a minute. Let me read this particular article once again from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, October 5th of 1991. This is an article by George Williamson of the San Francisco Chronicle. It's headlined, Keating Linked to Director of BCCI, subheaded, Lincoln Savings Owner Founded Company with Key Figure in Probes. It reads in part as follows, Lincoln Savings owner Charles H. Keating, Jr., who presided over the nation's most expensive SNL failure, founded a company and did millions of dollars of business with the director of scandal-ridden Bank of Commerce and Credit International. 5 years ago, Keating formed an offshore currency trading company called Trend Invest with Alfred Hartmann of Switzerland, a BCCI director and officer who has emerged as a key subject of Congressional and Federal Reserve Board investigations. Federal investigators are trying to determine whether Bahamas-based Trend Invest, that's T-R-E-N-D-I-N-V-E-S-T, was used by the International Bank as a conduit for laundering funds, sources said. BCCI stands accused of laundering drug money, financing terrorists, and secretly buying a string of U.S. banks in what has been called the worst financial scandal in history. Quote, This looks like the first evidence that the SNL and BCCI scandals had their merger points, unquote, said one congressional investigator on the BCCI case. Again quoting, it shows that the really rank financial scandals tend to be perpetrated by people who ran in the same crowd. One more time, this last paragraph. This looks like the first evidence that the SNL and BCCI scandals had their merger points, said one congressional investigator on the BCCI case. Again quoting, it shows that the really rank financial scandals tend to be perpetrated by people who ran in the same crowd. Unquote. Skipping down in the article, more about Mr. Alfred Hartmann, a very interesting fellow. Hartmann and Keating were two of Trend Invest's five directors. Keating's appointment logs show him meeting at least three times with Hartmann in 1986 and 87, including a shared helicopter ride from Miami to Cat Cay, an island in the Bahamas where Keating had a luxurious residence. In addition to his seat on BCCI's board of directors, Hartmann was also president of a BCCI-owned bank in Geneva until May of this year. That institution, Banque de Commerce et de Placement, was called a, quote, major link in the BCCI network, unquote, in a 1988 indictment, and the Financial Times of London, by the way, that is the paper that Anson Ng Yang was working for, and the Financial Times of London has reported that the Geneva Bank is under investigation for financing illegal arms sales. Hartmann also had an important position with the Banca Nazionale del Lavoro, or BNL, an Italian-based bank whose U.S. branch in Georgia was raided by the FBI in August of 1989, on suspicion of making $3 billion in illegal loans to the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein. Those loans reportedly helped finance Iraq's nuclear and chemical weapons research. BCCI funds frequently found their way to the Central Bank of Iraq by going through BNL's Georgia branch, according to regulator statements. Hartmann was chairman of a BNL subsidiary in Zurich, Switzerland. His simultaneous positions with BCCI and BNL have drawn intense interest from congressional and regulatory investigators, sources said. So basically, the thrust of this situation is that Hartmann, that's Alfred Hartmann of Switzerland, and Keating were two directors of a company called Trend Invest, and Hartmann, one of the directors of BCCI, also had connections to the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro. It says here he had an important position. It doesn't say exactly what that important position was, but it's worth noting, as indicated here, that the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro's Atlanta branch was the vehicle for a $3 billion loan to Saddam Hussein of Iraq. That loan is being investigated by Senator Gonzalez, or Representative Gonzalez of Texas, who heads the House Banking Oversight Committee. There appears to be a distinct possibility that those funds may actually have been used by Iraq to either invade Kuwait or, as it says here, to have financed Iraq's nuclear and chemical weapons research. It should be noted that the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro is part of the financial web surrounding the Banco Ambrosiano, the failed bank headed up by Roberto Calvi that was very much connected to the Vatican Bank. We went into that in Radio Free America program number 18. It's worth noting that the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro bought up the Argentine subsidiary of Banco Ambrosiano after the Banco Ambrosiano failed. That purchase, I believe, took place in 1985. It's worth noting here, too, that there is a statement by someone here which is reminiscent of the piece of information in the Napa Sentinel talking about Joseph Daniel Casolaro investigating connections between BCCI and 300 other financial institutions. It says here, reading once again, "This looks like the first evidence that the SNL and the BCCI scandals had their merger points," unquote, said one congressional investigator on the BCCI case. Again quoting, "It shows that the really rank financial scandals tend to be perpetrated by people who ran in the same crowd," unquote. That appears to have been one of the things that Joseph Daniel Casolaro was investigating. It should be noted that there is a very strong intelligence connection to the savings and loan scandals in Radio Free America program number, well, actually it's not a Radio Free America program, but a miscellaneous archive show about the CIA connections to the savings and loan scandals. Those particular connections are delineated at considerable length, relying primarily on research done by Pete Bruton of the Houston Post and also some information in the book Inside Job, The Lootings of America's Savings and Loan, by Mary Fricker, Paul Muolo, and Steve Pizzo. That archive show is available from Archives on Audio. So yet another indication of some of the connecting links between what Joseph Daniel, the tentacles of what Joseph Daniel Casolaro called the octopus. And so it remains to be seen just how many more connections emerge. But this is fascinating to me to see a key connection here between Charles Keating and the BCCI and the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, the connection under the circumstances being the aforementioned Alfred Hartmann of Switzerland. We have been looking at, among other things, some intersecting financial scandals which have to do with the intelligence community and international fascism. We took a look at the BCCI scandal, connecting links between that, and the savings and loan scandal, which has an intelligence connection too, and the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, the largest commercial bank in Italy. And we're going to take a look now at the death of a fellow who is directly connected to some of the financial scandals of decades past, namely Robert Vesco, a Vesco aide, a fellow named Norman LeBlanc, has apparently committed suicide, or at least we are told he committed suicide, as we have seen in connection with the Joseph Daniel Casolaro case. A verdict of suicide does not necessarily a suicide make when you're investigating the national security establishment or related connections. So I at least would hold open the death of Norman LeBlanc as not necessarily a suicide, given the circles he moved in and given the fact that some of the connections that Robert Vesco had established hover in the backgrounds of some of the ongoing investigations. Research credit on the following article goes to a listener who clipped this particular article from the Tico Times of Friday, August 9th of 1991. The Tico Times, by the way, is an English-language Costa Rican paper. This is by John McFaul, McPhaul, of the Tico Times. It's headlined, "Former Vesco Aide, a Suicide." It reads, "Norman P. LeBlanc, one-time accountant of fugitive U.S. financier Robert Vesco, was found dead last Monday morning in his mountainside home in San Jeronimo de Moravia, an apparent victim of suicide. LeBlanc's wife, Wendy, found his body in a room of the couple's sprawling house on their Monte Brumoso farm with a single bullet through his head from a .38 caliber pistol," said police authorities. LeBlanc, originally from Montreal, Canada, left a short suicide note which, according to judicial investigators, cited personal reasons for his decision to take his life. Friends said he had been suffering from depression. LeBlanc was survived by his wife and four children from a previous marriage. The naturalized Costa Rican citizen first came to this country in 1973 following Vesco, who at the time was fleeing several indictments for massive securities fraud in connection with the looting of the Investors Overseas Services, or IOS. Vesco had acquired IOS from British Wheeler dealer Bernie Kornfeld, only to fleece the mutual fund to the tune of $242 million, according to U.S. Security and Exchange Commission accusations. According to U.S. court records, LeBlanc came to IOS in July of 1971 from the prestigious accounting firm of Coopers and Lybrand, Lybrand, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, where he was the partner in charge of the SEC-ordered IOS audit. He became IOS Executive Vice President, Chief Financial Officer, and Director, and was eventually named as a co-conspirator along with Vesco and others in the fraud indictments. Vesco was indicted along with former U.S. Attorney General John Mitchell and former U.S. Commerce Secretary Maurice Stans in connection with an illegal $200,000 campaign contribution made by Vesco to the 1972 re-election campaign of former U.S. President Richard Nixon. Vesco and several of his associates, including LeBlanc, enjoyed the patronage of the late Costa Rican President José Pepe Figueres until 1978, when newly elected President Rodrigo Carazo threatened to make good a campaign pledge to boot Vesco out of the country, and the financier fled. He is now believed to be in Cuba. Skipping down, Though at the time LeBlanc described himself as happy enough, this is around 1977, shoveling manure and tending to animals on his farm, or pursuing his passion of cooking, he eventually returned to the financial consulting trade through a company called Caribbean Financial and Technical Consultants, which maintained offices in Costa Rica and Panama. Last paragraph again, because it's the most important in my opinion. Though at the time, and this is 1977, though at the time LeBlanc described himself as happy enough shoveling manure and tending to animals on his farm, or pursuing his passion of cooking, he eventually returned to the financial consulting trade through a company called Caribbean Financial and Technical Consultants, which maintained offices in Costa Rica and Panama. One of his more recent associates was Danny Fowley, F-O-W-L-I-E, who earlier this year was sentenced to 30 years in prison for drug trafficking in California, Tico Times, June 21st. LeBlanc negotiated the sale of property in the Southern Pacific Pavones region on behalf of Taponte S.A., a company controlled by Fowley, Tico Times, June 14th. In one letter to the buyer written on stationery of Rochester Holding Limited showing the same Costa Rican address as the Canadian's consultancy, LeBlanc described himself and Rochester as shareholders in Taponte S.A. So one of the questions I have, obviously, concerning LeBlanc's alleged suicide is whether it was really a suicide. I know nothing about Caribbean Financial and Technical Consultants, but with offices in Panama and Costa Rica, it at least suggests the possibility that there may have been some connection. Certainly, one has to look for the possibility that there may have been a connection between some of the shenanigans that have taken place in connection with the Contra support effort and what has been going on with Mr. LeBlanc. I don't know what the company was involved in, but Panama and Costa Rica are two of the main areas that have been implicated in some of the Contra-related drug traffic. And obviously, the Noriega trial is in full swing. It should also be noted, too, that Robert Vesco had very strong connections to the U.S. intelligence community. And in Radio Free America number 25, we went into Vesco's collaboration, or apparent collaboration, with people like Santos Trafficante, a mafioso and a defendant in the Christic Institute suit. The two of them were very much involved with attempting to set up a weapons manufacturing factory in Costa Rica. Specifically, they were going to be manufacturing Mitch Werbel's MAC-10 and MAC-11 machine pistols. And it's worth noting, too, that Robert Vesco, obviously, was an individual who was, as explained here, involved with an illegal contribution to the 1972 re-election campaign of Richard Nixon in the person of Alan Michael May, an individual who worked for Nixon and who apparently was involved, at least according to an article in the Napa Sentinel, which quoted information from Ari Ben-Menashe, a former Israeli intelligence agent. Alan Michael May was the conduit of a $40 million sum that had been originally donated by the Shah of Iran to the Richard Nixon re-election campaign. That had languished in a Mexican bank account that was then channeled back to the Khomeini forces in Iran to prime the financial pumps for the weapons deals attendant on the October surprise. It should be noted that 4 days after Harry Martin published this information in the Napa Sentinel, as mentioned in the Napa Sentinel article of 9/27, Alan Michael May was found dead, supposedly of a heart attack, but actually he turned out to have died as a result of polypharmaceuticals found in his system. It should be noted again that Alan Michael May asked Harry Martin not to publish the article because he said he feared for his life if the article was published. Unfortunately, one of the aspects of American political history that has been overlooked concerns the ongoing reality of political assassination in the United States or as a result of U.S. intelligence activity. One of the reasons why I ask questions about the death of Vesco's former aide and his accountant is that some of the activities that are being investigated, some of the various tentacles of the octopus, might have intersections with some of the activities that LeBlanc had knowledge of. Again, I know nothing about LeBlanc's Caribbean Financial and Technical Consultants, but he did appear to have connections to a fellow convicted of drug trafficking, Danny Fowley, and one wonders whether perhaps some of that drug trafficking might have been involved with the Contra support effort, and in turn whether perhaps LeBlanc had information about some of the various activities attendant upon the tentacles of the octopus. Certainly it may have been a suicide, maybe the guy was depressed, but we've seen an awful lot of, quote, suicides, unquote, in connection with various aspects of the octopus, which were not apparently suicides.